how'd you get involved with this exhibition, Kitsch exhibition? Or were you even aware of it before I let you know?
I wasn't aware of it. And then a friend of mine was in the show, and he said, hey, I saw your piece there. Then I found out about it. But the reason I was in the show is because the museum owns several works of mine. So they, you know, went in the back room and pulled out some pieces.
Yeah, yeah. It was your friend who told you about it? Was that Frank McIntyre?
Exactly.
Oh, okay, yeah. Great. Yeah, I spoke to him the other day. He wanted me to say hello to you for him.
Great, great.
So, well, what do you think about being involved in an exhibition that's called Kitsch, A Matter of Taste, Art, Kitsch, and Culture?
I think there's always a love-hate thing going on with the word kitsch. I think my first reaction, is that it's not my favorite word, but I realize that I deal with those areas.
In what way do you deal with those areas?
I deal with, like, pop culture and deal with people like Thomas Kincaid, which he's like the king of kitsch, so, you know, I know I get pulled in, you know, for those kind of things.
How do you deal with Thomas Kincaid? Is that evident in your artwork that you deal with him, or?
I haven't really made any art about him, but when he was alive, did the only sort of the art world version of retrospective of his work. Usually, like, galleries and museums in the art world, like, are very afraid to touch that subject. So I kind of did it because it was, like, a taboo area.
They're afraid to touch the subject of Kincaid?
Right.
The
fine art world just despises him. You know, he represents, you know, everything that they hate.
Why is that?
For one thing, the art is kind of like this sentimental art, and it's sort of painted in like a style that's like 100 years too late. And then they really don't like the fact that he would sell these prints of his art for a lot of money, and they were like basically like unlimited editions, and the people that were buying them thought they were buying real art, or they thought they were buying paintings, but it's just like a, you know, this mass printed object.
Oh, okay. So was he kind of misrepresenting what he was actually selling to people?
I just think that the people that were buying it didn't understand. They, like, didn't understand that it wasn't quite art, you know, because if you're going to make a print, it only has value, you know, if it's, like, done in a very limited edition. And these were done, you know, in, like, I don't know, you know, hundreds of thousands of prints. In a way, they're kind of worthless.
Yeah, that is really funny. And so what was the exhibition that you did you curate a show of his work or something?
Yeah,
okay.
I was asked to do this show in Santa Ana, California. It was at this place called the Grand Central Art Center, and they called me and wanted me to do this show. I could do like whatever I wanted in the show. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to show his original paintings, no prints, because everyone's seen the prints, but hardly anyone's seen the original paintings. And then what I was really interested in, you know, looking on the internet and looking on eBay, is that he has made almost every object you can imagine with his image on it. Like, God, you know, like teddy bears and like ceramic cups and bedspreads and wallpaper and lazy boys and pillows and just, you know, thousands of things. So in the exhibition, I wanted to have like one example of everything that he has made, which were thousands of objects.
So you actually had that many objects in the show?
Oh, yeah. he would work with these different factories that would make different things. Like, he had a whole line of like ceramics. So he had cups, plates, and things like that. So we like contacted that place, and they gave us stuff. And then he made like night lights, and we got a whole line of those, and he made teddy bears, and then we got those, and you just can't imagine the stuff that he's, you know, that has his name on it, like coffee he's had, and then like little electric trains, and I mean, it just goes everywhere.
And was he at all involved in the exhibition, or was it just kind of like a playful? You know,
no, he was totally involved. I mean, he had to agree to do it because he had to loan us all these works. He had agreed that we could borrow all these objects too. So he was involved in it. You know, I met with him several times. So he was in on it. You know, from the ground floor. And I think he had a good idea of what I was doing in the show.
Well, so that's really funny. You know, because you mentioned the art world has this disdain kind of feeling
right.
toward him. But do you don't share that same feeling about him or his work or?
How do I say it? I look at the world in a certain way and I think it's confusing to people, but I have sort of like two reactions to everything. So you know, I can see why people don't like it, and then I can also see why it's this amazing thing. You know, so I can kind of have like two opposite concepts happening at the same time.
Yeah, I understand
that. And most people can't. I mean, most people see Kincaid and they get some kind of a gut feeling.
Well, you know, the funny thing is at this museum in Utah here, that feeling usually for the people who are coming into this museum is, oh, great, Kincaid, I love Kincaid. Oh, fantastic.
Exactly.
Museum's finally showing some some beautiful artwork here.
Right.
Not all this conceptual garbage.
Yeah, well, I want to do the same thing in my show. I should try to explain that. Is I wanted that exact reaction. Like, I wanted the people that loved Kincaid to come in, and this was like the absolute pinnacle heaven of Kincaid, because everything was there, everything you could imagine. So people came in that loved Kincaid, and they loved the show. And then when Art World people came in, what I did is I laid on everything so thick, you know, almost like, you know, like too much candy, like it was like too sweet, and at the same time, they could see that it was ironic. So you know, at the same moment, it's irony and it's serious. And you can only tell a difference in your own mind. So people that loved Kincaid loved it. People that hated Kincaid got to love to hate him at the same moment. I think
sort of,
so. Yeah,
yeah, sort of playful, but it's also, I mean, they keep saying, well, we're not, you know, we're paying attention to our audience, which is a largely conservative audience, and they're not out to offend people also.
No. I wasn't either. I mean, first I had to please Thomas Kincaid, you know, so I can't do anything offensive. It has to be all approved by him.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, I can make everything clear and everything available so you can go in and make your own choice, like whether you're going to like it or not.
Yeah, well, that's really funny. So what year was that show?
That was 2004.
That's kind of toward the end of his life, right? Didn't he die in
right,
the last
right,
few years?
Yeah.
Interesting.
You know, want me to tell you something sort of secret about Kincaid?
Absolutely, yeah.
He had this secret life that a lot of people don't know about. I talked to him about it because he felt like he was, like, trapped in this sort of image of being, like, the goody-good artist, and, you know, he was thought of as a Christian and a family man and this whole thing. But he sort of hated that, but he was making so much money that, you know, he had to keep with that. But he had this secret life, which he had a different name. His name was Ed Aknick, which is Kincaid spelled backwards, and he would, like, dress up like a biker, like a Hell's Angel biker, you know, and he had this big beard, and he was, you know, he's like this like real tough guy kind of.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't think people know about the. It's like the dark side of Kincaid.
Yeah. See, I would like to see those landscapes from those scenes. That would be perfect in the Kincaid style. Maybe that's something that you can do to honor that legacy of Kincaid's alter ego there.
I'm trying to bring that forth because I, you know, I think within Kincaid, I think somewhere in there, he was an artist like anyone else, and he was sort of, you know, I thought of himself as sort of like a bad dude, but he just couldn't do it publicly.
But why is that?
I don't feel like he could do that publicly because he was making so much money. I mean, he was making like, you know, $100 million a year. And all these people around him were, like, pushing him in that direction, you know, because I think that he even wanted to sort of come out and be sort of more wild and crazy, but all of his handler people wouldn't allow it, you know. They, you know, I think a couple of times he tried to do that, you know, and they sort of pulled him back. Because he was just, you know, he's like the cash cow. He's just making so much money that they didn't want to upset that.
If you're Kincaid and you're making $100 million a year, you could do whatever you want.
Yeah, well, that was, you know, many of the times that I was talking with him, you know, I was talking to him about that and I was trying to encourage that in him and you know, tell him that it was okay. I thought at one point, you know, I almost had him convinced that he could do that, that he could come out as this rowdy performance artist and this whole thing. But it only came out kind of in secret.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I'm not extremely familiar with your work, but I do find what I've seen really interesting. And wouldn't you be a perfect person, I think, to explain that to him? Because isn't that a transition that you've sort of made, or
yeah.
You kind of do a lot of different things?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I can see both sides. I mean, I can see what he's doing. You know, also, I can see the artist in him, which other people can't. So yeah, I think I was one of the only people that could talk to him about that, and maybe like one of the only people that he felt safe in talking to me about that kind of thing.
Would you say that he was a good friend of yours? I mean, it seems like you had a pretty good relationship, and he was divulging, you know, his really interesting information to you.
Yeah, I mean, for a while, you know, while we were doing the show, and then he invited me up to see his studio. We kind of hung out and had dinner, and we stayed in contact for a long time. But I think finally, you know, it was like I said, it was like his handlers that finally said, you know, better cut this off.
Why would they do that?
Well, the money. It's the money.
But so it's like you were a bad influence on him with all your conceptual progressive
ideas? I
hope
ideas. So.
That's why I think it's so funny. Like, hey, you got to stop hanging out with this guy. He might turn you into a really interesting artist or something.
I was trying to. No, I had this whole plan set up. I was going to bring Kincaid to L.A. and have him meet, you know, all these crazy artists and just get him involved with this stuff. And that stuff didn't happen.
Who would you have introduced him to if he had said, okay, yeah, I want to come and really
Well, I had this whole thing planned. I was going to have a party, and I was going to have him come out and meet like Mike Kelly and Chris Burden and Robert Williams and just sort of this whole scene of artists, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of like the wild and crazy people.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know those guys personally, but that sounds like a really fun party to me.
Yeah, well, it was in the planning stages.
That's great. Can you tell me about, you know, you mentioned how he just couldn't get himself out of that because of all the pressures of all the money he was making and all those people around him, and that seems to be something that happens to a lot of people that make a lot of money. Have you found that to be something that's influenced decisions that you've made? Because you've done some pretty, I don't know if I'd say radical, but, you know, kind of progressive things that have sort of could be seen as controversial to a lot of people.
Yeah, well, that's my whole thing, you know, is I'm always trying to push boundaries. I'm always trying to do exactly what's completely wrong and kind of, like, infiltrate into, like, different areas.
And do you do things that you wonder, is this jeopardizing my career and my value? Because, I mean, you have a lot of people that are collecting your work and things like this. I mean, does that influence your – do you question what you're doing ever? Because
not at all, no. And I think the people that that like my work, that's what they expect me to do. I mean, it's not like I'm stepping on anyone's toes or, you know, I mean, this is my whole – mode of operation.
Yeah, it seems like you do the exact opposite, and that's why people are attracted to you in the first place. So why would you deviate from that? I wish more people would act that way instead of trying to please. I think it would be, you know, there'd be more interesting stuff going on.
But things aren't going in that direction. I think the art world's going more toward, you know, people trying to please.
In what way?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know. I can't speak for other artists, you know, but I'll just say what I do. You know, it's like I just try to think, you know, of like the most outrageous idea I can do at the moment, and then next time I want it to be more insane, and I keep pushing that boundary instead of thinking what the market wants or thinking what the collectors want. and making art for that. You know, like I said, I just want to do, like, everything wrong, everything backwards.
Yeah, I understand. And do you think that you're kind of on your own with that belief? Is that what you were sort of saying, that you think it's going in the opposite direction of people trying to please based on, you know, those kind of motives of, I got to still stay within this framework so that people will continue to collect my work and I continue to be relevant?
Well, I don't necessarily think that I'm on my own. I think in some ways it's like the natural reaction that artists have. Like I was saying, even Kincaid was tempted to go in that direction. I think there's hundreds of thousands of people that feel that way. But, you know, in this market, it's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah. How much attention do you pay to the market and the so-called art world and all of that, you know, the financial part of it?
I mean, well, of course, you know, I have to make a living. But I just feel like that, you know, if I make the best art that I can make, that somehow people will get that and people will be attracted to that in a way. I mean, in a way, it's kind of doing dealing with the art market in exactly the opposite way. Is, you know, I mean, I'm hoping there's enough people out there that will appreciate, you know, someone that is doing the exact opposite of what they want in the market. And that's, I guess, that's my marketing plan.
Well, it seems to be working for you.
Well, so far.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. I think it's cool. It seems to me like you're able to support yourself solely off of selling your artwork if that's what you want to do. But are you also involved in academia?
Yeah. I teach at UCLA and CalArts and sometimes at Otis. But my teaching is right in line with my artwork.
Mm-hmm. And so is it, do you teach because that's just something that you're really interested in doing, or is that something that you find to be something that helps you to be able to make a living?
I guess in theory, I really like teaching. You know, I like being with students, and I like talking to them, and I think it's, you know, it's kind of good to keep fresh in a way, to like talk to young people.
Mm-hmm.
But the other side of that is that, you know, if you've talked to anyone that's teaching, is that it's so draining, and it actually drains like the same energy that you would use to make your work. So you know, if you're teaching a lot, then you make less work.
Did you find that to be the case with you?
Oh yeah. No, I tried to figure out some way to like get around that. It's like, I mean, it's really strange because I actually enjoy teaching. Like when I'm there, I enjoy being with the students and I'm having a good time. And I can't figure out that when I'm done, why am I so completely drained, like a battery just gone, you know? And I was trying to just figure out, like, how do I get my energy back, you know? And I tried, like, you know, exercising or take, like, supplements or take a nap. You know, I've tried everything, and you know, nothing can sort of bring you back after that.
Yeah, I teach also. I know exactly what you mean, especially. It's one thing, not that I'm trying to undermine your the people that you have to teach, but imagine if you were like a seventh grade teacher in Englewood or something, how exhausting that would be.
I'm sure it would be even more exhausting.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm teaching at like CalArts, so I have like the, you know, some of the best students in the country, and I love them, mm-hmm. you know, and I want them to do well, and but it doesn't matter, you know, it still creates that drain, because I guess your brain and your mind and your soul only has so much creative energy, so you can either put it toward the students or put it toward your own work.
Yeah, definitely. I understand what you mean. What is it about CalArts, UCLA, Otis, these are the schools that you mentioned? These are, from my understanding, these are some of the most prestigious art schools in the whole world. What is it that makes those students so special? Like, what? Why are they so great? You know, I'm not being sarcastic at all. I just, you know, what is it that you think that appeals to, that connects them to get into CalArts and UCLA and these places, and what is it that separates them from the rest of the 99% of art students in the world?
You know, I can talk about CalArts, you know, and what happens there, and you know, I think in some ways it's not that it's less academic, but they have a lot of freedom there to do whatever they want, and you know, I've taught in other schools where it's like the students don't have as much freedom. I mean, in a way, they're sort of, you know, told exactly how to paint, told exactly how to draw. And at CalArts, it's not like that at all. It's like, in a way, it's like they're not even teaching them like a craft. You know, it's like nobody sits down and say, you know, you draw the eyeball like this or something. And it's just they're given like total freedom to do whatever they want.
And then, so then that kind of fosters the conceptual part of it and their creativity.
Right.
Very interesting. And what subjects do you teach there?
I taught this class, it's called the Art of Infiltration.
That sounds
and
great.
And then I taught this, this sort of this, it was called, Holy Crit, and it was for all the students that basically, there was this new thing happening at CalArts where you would have all these students of faith, like you'd have like born again Christians, and you had Islamic students and Mormon, and the school didn't know exactly what to do with them. So I said, I'll take them. So I did a class, you know, sort of about faith, and that was a blast.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting.
It was. Yeah.
Well, so what were you guys doing? It was a what was the nature of the curriculum for that?
God.
That might be the answer right there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this was what I thought, is that, you know, I sort of based the class upon the fact that in the art world, having faith is not smiled upon. You know, it's kind of like the worst idea, in academics or in the art world to sort of express any kind of faith in anything. I mean, you can easily make fun of stuff. You can make fun of everything, but to like take something seriously at this point in history is just not cool. So I like doing everything backwards. So then I thought that was a great idea. So just, you know, bring them all in, and it was just wild, the things that happened in there. You know, because there's like every viewpoint, you know, like I said, there's Islamic students and born again, and also half the class were atheists, but really, like, you know, staunch atheists, and just the things that we talked about was just incredible.
Yeah, I can imagine. That sounds very interesting.
And I just sort of, you know, I like it again. I like things that nobody else will touch, in a way, and that's like how I have fun.
Yeah, that's something that makes you relevant, because you're approaching things in that unique way. That's fantastic. Do you find inspiration from that type of thing? You know, the conversation that you have with your students and from teaching your students.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think about that a lot. You know, it's kind of crazy, the things that I'm reading. You know, because I'm reading the Quran and reading a lot of Buddhist stuff and a lot of Christian stuff. And then also, like, you know, all this weird stuff, you know, stuff about aliens and paranormal, and I kind of put it all in one bag, in a way.
And is that shaping the work that you're currently working on? What are you doing now?
I guess so, yeah. What am I working on now? I don't know what I'm working on at the moment. I just finished a major exhibition that in the fall, so that was just a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going in a new direction, and what that is, I'm not sure yet.
What was the exhibition in the fall?
The exhibition in the fall, it was an exhibition about this performance piece that I did in London. I hired five psychics, and I made sort of a panel out of them, and there was an audience. So I hired the five psychics, and then I had them channel – five famous dead artists, and then you could ask them questions.
And was that something that was at a museum or a commercial gallery?
It was at the Frieze Art Fair in London.
Okay.
At the Frieze Art Fair, of course, you know, they have all these booths of art that they're selling. So they try and do something different, something that's not for sale. So each year they ask artists to, like, do a piece or do a project. So that was my project.
Yeah. So do you think that you enjoy doing more conceptual works like that aren't really meant to be sold, or do you just, you know, like doing all the kinds of art that you do?
I don't really think of the sales at the moment. If I thought of that, I wouldn't do anything.
Yeah.
If I thought of what was going to sell, I just try and think of, I'm just trying to, you know, push boundaries. And I'm hoping that other people will think it's cool and will want to buy the work. But it's sort of opposite of what you might do.
Yeah. But you must have some kind of at least a subconscious feeling about, you know, if you're doing a two-dimensional painting, then that's a thing that's a typical art object that's bought and sold versus the psychic thing. You know, it's like, oh, well, how do you, if someone wanted to buy that, maybe there's a video or something like that. But
there's a video, and I made these things that are called, like, spirit photos of each of the artists that were sort of channeled, and then I made all these sort of relics.
Okay.
So there were, like years later, after the show, after the performance, then there was an exhibition, and then there were things that people could buy. And I just hope that, you know, all I hope is that people will think it's cool and want it.
Well, that's really interesting. So is that a typical approach that you have if you're doing a more experiential type of a project, that there's going to be some kind of objects involved that are these, you know, some sort of memorabilia type things that can then act as reminders to people in the future who couldn't be at the event?
Yeah. Because, the original event, there was about 200 people there, and there's a video of it, you know, that's available. But I wanted to go further, you know. It's like I made like a transcript of everything that the spirit said, and then I looked through that and tried to find information. And it was from that I made the other objects, you know. If they talked about anything in the spirit, you know, I tried to make that object, you know. So I was, you know, trying to take what they were saying in like a literal way.
Can you give me an example of one of those? I think I understand what you're talking about, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, one of the artists that was being channeled was Marcel Duchamp.
Uh-huh.
The psychic was, you know, channeling Duchamp, and then you know, he was talking about this and that, and then all of a sudden he stopped, and he was like feeling like around his hands, you know, and I couldn't tell what he was doing, and he was kind of feeling like the cuffs of his shirt, and he said something like, "Cufflinks, my cufflinks, they're lost." And then he started crying, and then he started laughing, and it made no sense to me at all. Like, what is he talking about? About his cufflinks, you know? And it actually took a long time to figure out what he meant. But later on, I found out that there's an English company called Duchamp that makes cufflinks. So I think it was kind of like a joke he was telling about this company, you know, like how absurd, you know, that they're making these things in his name, you know. But I, you know, I sort of had to do this research to figure out what the hell he was trying to say. So the piece that I made was the spirit was talking about mother of pearl cufflinks. So I went to that shop and bought those exact cufflinks, the mother of pearl cufflinks. And then I got this Catholic reliquary and sort of put them in there. So it's sort of like a spirit object. So, like I said, sort of taking what he was saying, like, literally. He's talking about the cufflinks. Okay, here they are. This is what he's talking about.
I understand. Who were the other artists that you had the psychics channel?
Yeah, there were five of them. So one was Leonardo da Vinci and Marcel Duchamp, and Frida Kahlo, and Vincent van Gogh, and Jackson Pollock.
Why'd you choose those artists?
Yeah, it was a very specific reason why I chose those, because I felt like in sort of like the public's imagination is people kind of have an idea of who they are. Like they can imagine what they might say. I think like all of them, you know, maybe, or most of them, you know, have had movies made about them, and they're kind of like these bigger than life artists. If I picked somebody more obscure, it would be harder to figure out, does that sound like them? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So in our imagination, we have an idea of what somebody might sound like. So I picked those artists, and many of them are, you know, some of the artists that I like.
Yeah, well, those are popular. Those are good ones. Right. Yeah, I'd like to hear what they had to say from the other side. Definitely. Are you aware of which pieces of yours are in the Kitsch exhibition at the Nora Eccles Harrison Museum of Art?
I believe so. You can tell me if I'm wrong, but it's I think there's two paintings.
Yeah.
One of them is from like the 70s, and it's a painting. It's like a self-portrait of myself meeting Smokey the Bear.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's right.
There's that. And then there's a painting from the 80s, sort of a portrait of anchorwoman Connie Chung.
Exactly. Yeah. Do you have anything that you could, any anecdotal stuff that you could provide about those pieces?
Because I'm
so interested in learning more about them, and I've been taking people on tours and telling them and just kind of posing the questions of, like, what do you think this artist is trying to do with this?
Yeah.
And it's very interesting to hear the artist's point of view.
Yeah. Well, I'll talk first about the Smokey the Bear one. And that, of course, it's from the 70s. And, you know, talking about kitsch and pop culture, at that time, I made it a point to, like, try and meet all these, like, corporate mascots. So I went out and met, like Ronald McDonald and like, the Jack in the Box clown and little Oscar, sort of the hot dog guy, and then there was these different things, and then there's Smokey the Bear. So it's all these sort of corporate mascots, these people that dress up in these costumes and then appear at these different places. So I heard that Smokey the Bear was coming into town, so I wanted to go see him.
So that's a illustration of an actual.
Yeah, yeah.
You actually did meet him. Okay, so we all were thinking that it was just this imagined.
No, it actually happened. I went to go see him. He was like appearing at a ranger station up in the mountains. So I, you know, drove up there, and it was mostly, you know, kids that were seeing him. But I wanted to meet him. And I always think there's something really weird about the painting and about Smokey. If you like look at him, his, like, pants are too thin. His pants are just hanging on him because I guess they were supposed to, like, you know, get, like, pillow and, like, stuff his pants or stuff his chest, you know, to be more like a bear, but they didn't do that. So the costume just kind of, like, hung on him.
Why would they do that? Because it was just really hot or something or what?
I don't know. Maybe they didn't think of it. Maybe they didn't have a pillow. You know, maybe they just said, "Hey Joe, can you put this costume on?" And he puts it on, and they didn't know that they had to have stuffing. I don't know, but I just thought that was odd, and it looks kind of odd in the painting too, because the pants are just sort of hanging there.
Yeah, that's that is
but,
funny.
You know, in all my art, you know, it's I'm always trying to like interact with people, you know, interact with Kincaid, interact with all these mascots, interact with politicians and spirits and religion and all these different things. You know, I try to get as close as I can to these subjects.
In the background, he has his truck, and the hood is open. We've always wondered about why is the hood open, and the mountain that's behind him seems like it may have just been burned by a forest fire or something.
Well, it's Southern California, so it's pretty dry. It was up in the mountains, and it's not that green. It's kind of, you know, bushy, scrubby. So that's how it was. And the truck is like, if you look at it, it has some like, ranger station sort of decal on it. And I guess it was like some big, I can't recall what the truck was. Maybe it was probably like a firefighting truck. Like maybe it was like a big water tanker or something. And they just had the hood open because it's kind of like a hot rod, you know, they sort of had all their vehicles out so you could look at them so I guess they wanted you to look at the motor. So
I see. So it wasn't that he was broken down on the side of the road and you came to his rescue. That's what we were wondering if. Oh,
I like that idea though.
No, it's funny to hear you just like, oh yeah, I just went and met Smokey Bear one time. We're all coming up with these ridiculous stories about, well, we didn't. I never thought, oh, it's a guy in a costume. I thought, no, this is the real Smokey the Bear. This is an illustration of his dream of meeting Smokey the Bear. I didn't even ever.
It really happened. It's all real. And
yeah.
Let me say that about my work right now is that it's always that way. Even though it's insane, it's always real. I always go through the motions. It always comes from some real event or real facts. Like in my work, I don't make up anything. You know, even with the spirits talking, it's sort of like, okay, I just let them talk. You know, it's like, I'm not making that up. This is what the psychics are saying. I can't say whether it's a real spirit or whether we're getting ripped off, but it doesn't matter because they are presenting it as real.
Yeah, I think that's a cool theme to have throughout your work, definitely. Yeah, I wouldn't have thought that, yeah. But now that I think back, I'm thinking about the letter to Jesse Helms and stuff, and I think that does make it, that makes it more interesting in that way, that reality part of it.
Yeah, because I think reality is so much more funny than making stuff up, and it's weirder than what you can make up, and then it's more twisted. Like if you think that it's fake, and then you find out that it's real, it's like even more weird.
Yeah, definitely. Fantastic. Well, hey, so what about the Connie Chung piece? Do you have any?
Yeah, the Connie Chung. You know, I was living in L.A. In the late 70s and the 80s, and she came on local TV there at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought she was great. You know, I'd watch her news show, and that was when she was just in L.A. I started writing her letters about different things, and then I would always ask for, like, a new photo, like every year, because she would, like, change her look a little bit. She'd change her hair. So I started to get all these photos of her, and then these letters, we'd talk about certain things. And then I made the painting of Connie Chung. And then later, I sent her a photograph of the painting, and I wanted to get her idea of what she thought of the painting. So I did that. So it's like, it's, you know, it was based on this correspondence, these letters. I actually never met her in person, but it went on for years, you know, and then finally, you know, she became nationwide, and then she moved to New York. So during that whole time, I was writing her. And then I guess she, like, finally figured out, you know, I'm an artist. This is what I do and so forth.
What was her opinion of the painting?
She was trying to be diplomatic, you know, trying to say that she liked it. And but then she said something like, well, you certainly have some interesting imagery there, which is kind of saying, like, you know, what the fuck? Oh, sorry.
No, it's fine. It's fine. You're going to be.
But, yeah, I mean, I just let her say whatever she wants. And I guess, you know, like, some people think that I'm trying to get away with things, that I'm, like, fooling people, you know, that I'm doing stuff without them knowing it. And it's not that at all. It's like I always include the people in what I'm doing, and I always tell them exactly what I'm doing.
That's the case with Connie Chung. You were kind of were saying, gave her the background of what you were doing, and that you. Oh, okay.
I mean, at some point, at first it was just, you know, like all these pieces evolve. You know, at first it just was a letter writing thing.
I see.
The painting came later.
Yeah.
And then I included the painting, you know, as part of the whole piece.
So when you sent the first letter, is it that you had already came up with the idea that you wanted to start this correspondence with Connie Chung, and that was going to become part of an artwork later on? Or is it just that you have you create these relationships that then they naturally develop, and you go, oh, okay, this is actually turning into something interesting that I'll share with others?
Right, right. It's more like that. Like, at the time, you know, maybe I'm writing to, you know, hundreds of different people, and I really don't have an idea about where it's going to go. I kind of let the correspondence letters sort of take them into a direction, and you know, sometimes things don't go anywhere. You know, sometimes people don't write back, or they write back, but then nothing happens. And then other times, you know, they're more friendly, and then things last for years and years.
Well, I think that's a really cool part of what you do, because there's this authenticity to that then. You know, that it's, you're doing
yeah.
things, and this is actually who you are and what you actually are doing with your life. And then some of these things turn into art projects that you share with other people, because probably you think that they'll find it interesting too, but it's not that you're
so.
Just doing it as this, you know, just to get to make these artworks and to get attention in that way. So I think that really, probably people find that really appealing.
I hope so. And in a way, that's done sort of backwards too. It's like I'm constantly doing all these things, you know, taking these different directions. And it's only when something happens as part of it that it becomes an artwork. There's a lot of things, like I said, that don't go anywhere. So it only becomes art afterward. You know what I mean?
Yeah, of course. I think that's the best way for it to turn into art, actually.
You sort of look back and then you kind of say, well, where's the art in this? Okay, here it is.
Do you think that you'd be still would be doing a lot of those same things if it weren't that there's always that possibility that it'd turn into something that other people would care about because you are who you are?
Exactly. And let me tell you one thing. I started doing this when I was a child. I don't know. I was like maybe 9 or 10. Started doing writing and started meeting people and started creating these weird situations. And I didn't call it anything. I didn't call it art. It didn't even occur to me that it was art. It just was something that I did. And it wasn't until later, when I went to college, that I sort of looked back upon what I was doing. There wasn't a good name for it, but calling it art was like the closest thing to like what it is. So in a way, that's backwards too. It wasn't like, oh, I'm setting out to do art. No, it's sort of like, I want to do these things, and it doesn't make any sense, but maybe it makes sense if I call it art.
And, I mean, you're in L.A., and you're around a lot of people who are interested and educated on contemporary art and conceptual
right.
art. However, you know, there are a lot of people who probably would say a lot of these things that you do, like, well, why is that art? You know, the painting, of course.
Yeah.
That's what they think of as art, but especially we run into this in Utah. When I talk about things that I do and social engagement and stuff, they're like, well, why is that art? Do you care if what you're doing is considered art, or is it just that it's interesting?
I think it has to be interesting first, and then maybe it can be art. And one thing that I realize that when I do is I kind of go beyond the definition of art. I always go beyond what it's supposed to be about. So it's like, for people that are trying to give it a title, even trying to say it's performance art or it's conceptual art, it does not really fit any definition that exists. So I think that's great, but then it causes confusion for people in the art world because they're trying to give it a name and there's nothing that exists.
Yeah. How do you categorize those type of things that you do, like the psychic project? Is there a category that you put that
yeah.
into?
I call it infiltration art.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by infiltration is that I go out in the world, out into culture, out in these different areas, and sort of infiltrate them, whatever it is, whether it's, you know, corporate mascots, or whether it's like religion, or whether it's politics, whatever, pop culture, try and get on the inside of these things and try and figure out how they work, and then do pieces from the inside, like always working on the inside of these things. You know, I know it drives some people crazy, you you know, because, like I said, it doesn't follow any definition that they understand.
Is that term, infiltration art, something that you came up with?
Yeah. I'm trying to, you know, create a name, sort of context, where they can understand all the work.
And then I do recall that you said that you were teaching a class on that. And are there other artists, either people who were, you know, influenced by you that were your students or otherwise who put themselves or some of the work that they're doing in that same category?
Well, you know, I did a lot of research on this idea, infiltration, and I realized that whether it's art or not, there's certain rules that exist in infiltration. Whether you're bi and trying to infiltrate, you know, into another government, or whether you're making a film, or whether you're an artist, or whether you're a prankster, but there's these certain rules of infiltration that I tried to understand. So in the class, I sort of teach them that. So, and then I show them certain films where they can see these rules and actions happening. You know, and we read certain things and look at artists and things in the world where infiltration sort of operates.
Yeah, well, it's good for you for coming up with your own category that other people can, you know, say, oh, well, this is art, and look, this other guy's doing it, and this is, so that does help, I think, for other people who may be doing interesting things who don't realize it's art or, you know, don't know what it is, but it might be really cool that you can kind of be the precedent that they look to for validation if other people are saying, well, what are you doing? You're just wasting your time. And,
right.
And, of course, well, there's...
Well, I really hope so, you know. I mean, I'm not sure if it's a movement that's going to catch on. I think there's elements of that in different people's works and in the world. I think it's like something you can understand in a way.
Yeah, definitely. Hey, one other thing. Are you at all, I know you said you teach at UCLA, and I did some research on the Made in LA 2014. I know that's coming up this year, too. Do you know anything about that, or are you involved with any of that stuff?
In a way, you're talking about the Made in LA that's at the Hammer Museum?
Yeah. The kind of recent biennial thing they're doing?
Yeah. I've been in the Hammer's biennial exhibition. I was in that in 2009, so I've been in that show, and I know several people that are going to be in this next show. And, you know, it's like every year they're trying to highlight, you know, different artists, you know, different things that are happening, new things. So yeah, it's great. It's a great venue.
And that's something that they... It seems like from the last one, they kind of look to UCLA students or recent graduates, or I don't even know if they were still students or just getting out of there, to kind of show these new people, and they're not necessarily looking for huge names, but just what's interesting and going on. I think that's kind of an admirable mission for them to have with that.
Yeah, I like that. There's always more, you know what I mean?
And
maybe, you know, if you're interested, we can do another talk on like a different subject, you know, if you think of it.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, man, that'd be great. I mean, I'm...
There is a really interesting piece that the museum has that's not in this exhibition. I think they show it once in a while, but it's even an earlier piece from the early 70s. That's a totally different piece. It's like this electronic machine. Maybe they'd show it to you if you went in the back. I don't know.
Is this a piece that you did or a different piece?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but I guess it's, you know, it doesn't fall within the range of kits. It's like a, you know, it's a whole different thing.
And what's the title of that piece?
It's called the C-82, C-82. You know, it's this electronic sculpture that they got. And then I just found, like, all the notes and all the diagrams and drawings that I did in the 70s, so the research to do the piece, and I just gave them that, too. So I gave them, like, several, like, folders of, you know, diagrams and things that they also have.
Oh, cool. Well, you know, you're talking about electronics from the 70s, and I know that the museum has a lot of pieces like that, and they just have so many problems because, you know, the technology, they're trying to connect it to a you know, a MacBook or whatever, and it just doesn't work, and then they have all these things where they're really cool pieces, but we don't know how to figure it out, and the artists are not available, or they don't know how to explain it to us either, and just nobody does, so I think they're... Sometimes they get a little bit exhausted with that type of thing.
Well, I know. I mean, I have like several of these pieces from the 70s that every once in a while I have to work on, and then all of a sudden you can't even buy parts. You know,
Yeah, exactly.
From the 70s electronic pieces, and it's like having like an antique piece of hardware, kind of.
Yeah. Have you ever been to the museum, or you just have interacted with them?
No, I'd love to. I'm waiting for them to invite me up, maybe to do a lecture or something.
Yeah, that would be great, you know, and I'll recommend that to Mark Lee Coven, who does this art system residency and big elaborate program that's going to be happening
in
2017, and it's art integrated with sciences. I don't know if that would be a particular connection, but they, of course, you know, it's a university.
The electronic piece is pretty scientific.
Oh, that's true, yeah. Well, I'll remind him of that, yeah, and they do like to tap into the museum's collection when they can. You just heard an extended interview with artist Jeffrey Valance, whose work is in the exhibition at the Nora Eccles Harrison Museum of Art, A Matter of Taste, Art, Kitsch, and Culture. And that will be on view at the museum until May 7th. With Utah Public Radio, I'm Mikey Kettinger.